Okay. We're going to start by finishing off the Arizal. The Chida says the Arizal was not able to write anything down. The reason why he went, and they asked him, why doesn't he write anything down? So the Arizal said, it's impossible. Impossible for him to write down. As a matter of fact, the Arizal said, he had such a massive flow of Chiddush, it was extremely difficult for him to even express it verbally. Even difficult for him to express it verbally. And to take the time to write it down, he went to channel it and find it, to write it down, he wasn't able to do. Now, just just an example from the world at large. It's truly the Havdil. But they say that Mozart, I don't remember which symphony it was, but one of his symphonies, someone asked him afterwards, how long did it take you to come up with this one? So he said, 2 minutes. It took him 2 minutes to conceptualize everything. But I mean, it's 20 minutes, 20, 25 minutes symphony. And I'm sure it took him a lot longer than that to write it down. So, the human mind works a lot faster than speech, and certainly than the hand. So, the Arizal had an unbelievable flow, which he was definitely not able to write, and he said he was almost not able to say. Okay, we didn't do as much of it, because if I talked about everyone, then we'd still be back in the early Rishono. But Tzfat in the mid-late 1500s was, the golden era. It's a volcano eruption, that's what it is. It's a mamash volcano eruption of one guddle after another. There was, of course, as mentioned, the Radbaz, the Mabit, Rabbi Yosef Karo, and all these people were well-known, recognized experts in the regular, normal facets of Torah. The Radbaz was from 1480 to 1573 and had been a well-known, Marbitz Torah, Rabbi Rosh Hashiva from the early 1500s. And they actually say that when the Arizal started teaching Sisrei Torah, started teaching the secrets of Torah to people, it's after the Radbaz was in Tzfat, they say the Radbaz called him in and told him he shouldn't be doing it. Because you can't, it's not simple to reveal the hidden Torah. And they say, and this is brought in reliable sources, and they say, I think the Chidor, I'm pretty sure the Chidor brings it. They say that the Arizal, talked in learning, discussed it with the Radbaz, and showed him what he knows, or showed him some of what he knows, and the Radbaz said, okay, you're right, you're definitely a competent person to be doing it. And this is if we want to know why the Ari is so accepted by Torah world at large. And again, as we discussed last week, exactly what part of and how to relate to the fact that the Kabbalah Sari is considered, was through the medium of Gilui Aryeh we spoke about last week. But the reason why it's accepted so largely, and there's no one of substance in the Torah world who really argues with it, who argues with the validity of the Aryeh. In other words, I told you guys that the Gaon does argue with the Ari many times. He definitely does argue with the Ari, but he doesn't argue with the Ari as a Manda Omar. The Ari is like overreaching his bounds and it's not right, etc., etc. So he doesn't go there, he doesn't do that. He argues with the Ari in terms of Torah. But the reason why the Ari is so widely accepted is he wasn't in a vacuum, he wasn't a guy sitting out, he wasn't a guy in left field. Again, yeah, he wasn't in left field. He wasn't in an isolated island. He wasn't in a small community. He was literally in the middle of a volcano eruption of Terra, Nigla and Nistor. There are other people there also. And because all these people, you know, recognized the Ari as an authority, then that's why the Ari has the place historically that he has. That's why this place is definitely beyond doubt. Okay. Historically speaking, the Ari had two main Talmidim. Now, he had really more than that, but he had two main Talmidim in terms of, you know, this is a history class. I mean, historically speaking, I mean, in terms of propagation of the Ari's Torah, of the Ari's ideas, there were two main Talmidim. One was Reb Shaul Sarug, or Saruk, and the other was Reb Chaim Vital. Now, what's his name? Rabbi Goldwein, our scrolls, Shaul Yachronim, states that Reb Shaul Sarug, Saruk, learned by the Ari before Reb Chaim Vital. And I have yet, I'm not sure what his source for that is. I was not able to verify that idea. But that's really not the most important issue. The Ari himself in his life, you know, as I believe I said last week, the reason why he went to Tzfas was in order to give over the secrets of Torah to Reb Chaim Vital. That's why he went to Tzfas. And the Ari himself felt
Tavka to him?
Tavka to Reb Chaim Vital, yeah. Specifically, Reb Chaim Vital was the person who he was supposed to give over Sifrei Torah to, the secrets of Torah. And as I mentioned last week, I think I said the story of
Reb Chaim
Vital
about him.
Say again?
Shouldn't Reb Chaim Vital about him to learn?
Reb Chaim Vital was living in Tzfas already.
Right.
So apparently, I saw in what I consider a somewhat reliable source that it was important for the Ari to come to Eretz Yisrael because of quotes Kedushas Haaretz or issues like that. Show this one to Rabbi Meir; he'll be very excited about it.
It wasn't just to.
No, it was primarily it. Mashma, I'd have to go back over again. If the source I saw and I consider, I have enough questions on enough of his statements. I mean, it's a source. It's not, you know, it's a source. It's the person who wrote it. I don't have it down yet. I've been looking through it. I bought it a couple of weeks ago. I've been looking through it. So I'm not sure exactly how to classify it completely. I'm not sure how to completely classify it. Anyway, so, yeah.
Do you have any type of astrophic literature from Larry?
We'll get there soon. We're going slowly, and we'll get through the Ari himself again. The Ari didn't write anything down.
Right.
We'll get there. We're going to definitely get through Reb Chaim Vital tonight. And as we get through Reb Chaim Vital, then you'll be clear about that. Okay, so, the Ari himself felt that he should limit people who he teaches, and I don't know, only Reb Chaim Vital, but only to a very, very small select group. Reb Chaim Vital argued with the Ari and thought that the Ari's Torah is so important. The Ari's Torah is so important that more people should be exposed to it. Now, even though it's brought clearly in many accurate sources, the Ari argued with Reb Chaim Vital about this. Nonetheless, when the Ari was saying his shiurim in Nigla and Nistor, he didn't stop when Reb Chaim Vital brought other people in. And that definitely is a way, if you don't have to teach, you know. There was you guys ever heard of the yeshiva in Long Beach? Long Beach, no? No, no, no? Okay. The old Rosh Yeshiva in Long Beach. No, okay. The old Rosh Yeshiva in Long Beach was Yitzchak Feigelstock. Yitzchak Feigelstock held that. He said when he was saying shirum, he didn't let any outsiders come in. If an outsider came in, he said no, nope, he won't talk. He would either just not say anything substantial, or wait till the person left. So there's a way if you really, if you want, Or if you don't want people to listen to your shiurim, there's a way to stop it. Don't say the shiur. So the fact that the Ari went along with Ruchai Vital is a certain tacit agreement through Ruchai Vital that he could bring in some more outsiders. Now, it seems to me, and again, I only saw this in the sefer I have called Divrei Yosef, that I'm not sure how to rank it in terms of accuracy at the present moment. Some of these stories are relatively well known. Unfortunately, the Shivchei Ari, which is like the prime source of these things, not able to get a hold of at the present moment. But they formed a group in Sfas. It was about a year and 5 months approximately. There was a group of people, Talmidei Ari, who were called the Chaverim. Chaver means friends. These were the group of the Talmidei Ari, and it seems, based on careful reading and understanding of different things said about the Chaverim, that even the Ari understood it was dangerous, but there was also deep potential there. There's a number of famous stories, which I'm not sure which ones are really authentic, which ones aren't really authentic, so I'm not going to say anyone over right now, but there are a number of famous stories that Ari felt there was potential amongst this group of Chaverim, if they would stay all together, to, bring Mashiach. Ari felt. And even though it was dangerous, he felt it was worth a try. And then that was Ki'ilu, part of what he was trying to do. Are they named after the Chaverim of Mishnah and Shas? Sort of. Now, the one of the key stories is that two of the Chaverim's wives started arguing, and Ari told them this is fatal. And now there's pirud. Now that we're fighting with each other, we've lost our chance. And shortly after that, the Ari died. The Ari died, hay of 1572. And if you're in Eretz Yisrael, it's a big. It's not as big as like Ba'omer, but it's a big pilgrimage. Hay of beginning, a little before Tisha B'Av. Okay, now after the Arizal's death, there is a basic machlokas between Reb Chaim Vital and Reb Shaul Saruk. And that is, should they continue limiting the Kabbalas Ari or not? Should they teach it to a wider group of people, or they should have moved? Reb Chaim Vital, Ki'ilu, felt he learned the lesson from the Ari's premature death, and he held it should be limited. And we'll see, Bezer Hashem, in a couple of minutes, how much he felt that, how strongly he felt about that. On the other hand, Reb Shaul Saruk disagreed, and people believe he definitely made at least one trip to Italy, and taught over the Kabbalah Sari to people in Italy, including the Ramami Pano, which is Rabbi Nachum Azariah of the city of Pano or Fano in Italy, who initially had printed the Ramak. Initially printed the Ramak, he later became a big, what's the right words, a big fan. I don't know, fan's not really a nice enough word, of the Ari. Okay, fine. Right. Reb Chaim Vital was born in 1543 in Sfas. He died in 1620 in Damascus. It's obvious that Reb Chaim Vital grew up in the golden era of Sfas. He initially learned by Rabbi Yosef Kara. It's right, not bad. Afterwards by the Alshich. And that was learning regular Torah, as we call it. However, he also, I mean, it's, you know, again, I think I said this, but you never know. I had a guy last night. And we were discussing the word Eitza. And the guy claims that no one ever explained exactly what Eitza means. And the last night was the first time he realized Eitza means advice.
Really?
What?
He doesn't mean if he was retarded or not.
No, I mean, like, was there a background
with this guy? Yeah, so I don't remember if I said this last week, but I may have, or may have said it many other times, but I'll say it again, because, you see, sometimes, I'm sure many of his rebbeim told him what Eitz meant, but it didn't quite go in. Sometimes it takes different information to penetrate for different people many or more times. It's obvious that a person has to have a basic, if not a deep level of competency in regular Torah in order to understand Sisrei Torah, in order to understand the secrets, the Kabbalistic parts. But I'm not sure how many times I've said it or not, but I'm going to repeat it again. Again, here we see the Rav Vital. Rav Vital was competent Talmud Chacham before he started learning the Kabbalah. Now, Rav Vital Ki'ilu, I mean, he's known mainly for Kabbalah, and he's like very historical. In other words, I said last week that the Ramak started the process of clarifying, synthesizing Kabbalah, and then the Ari came and superseded and did a lot more. And there's still a certain relationship between the two. And similarly, in a very apropos historical happening. Reb Chaim Vital originally learned by the Ramak, and after he learned by the Ramak, he learned by the Ari. After he learned by the Ramak, he learned by the Ari. Now, there's a well-known story, which I didn't see I saw it brought very briefly in the Chidah, which is a really accurate source, and I saw it brought other places also briefly. He brings a slightly, Rebbe Goldworm brings a slightly more Arichas, a lengthy version of it. When the Reb Chaim began, the Ari came to Tzvas to teach Reb Chaim Vital. That's what he came to Tzvas for. And initially, Reb Chaim Vital was not able to absorb the Ari's Torah. And I believe the way he says it, Rabbi Goldworm, is that the Ari would teach and Reb Chaim Vital would fall asleep. So after a little while, the Ari took Reb Chaim Vital to Tveria. This is a well-known story. He took him to Tveria. He says again, I didn't see this in the other sources, but he says they got in a boat and they went out to the middle of the Kinneret. Certain spot, they get to a certain spot. The Rebbe says, okay, the Be'er Shel Miriam is right here. They put a cup in. He gives Reb Chaim Vital a cup of water to drink from the quotes Be'er Shel Miriam. From the Be'er Shel Miriam. And afterwards, Reb Chaim Vital was able to understand, absorb, and not fall asleep, and remember all the Rebbe's Torah. It's a relative well-known story. Don't ask me to say a real pshat in that story. It's definitely beyond me.
What do you mean that's pshat?
Okay, we're not going to get. I don't think we're going. We should get to the Maral, but I'm not sure how deep in the Maral we'll get. But if we'll get deep enough into the Maral, you'll understand what I mean when I say I don't understand pshat in that story. Okay, maybe we should actually make it through everything I have here, but we'll see. Let's see. Okay. As we mentioned already, the Ari died in the summer of 1572. Right before he died, he called in all the Chaverim. All the Chaverim again means all that group of people who were learning Kabbalah by him. And he told them all to stop after he dies. Told them all to stop.
Stop teaching?
Or? Stop learning. Except for Reb Chaim Vital. The only one who should continue on learning is Reb Chaim Vital. Now, the Chidah also says that the Ari forbade the other Chaverim to write down the Ari's his Torah. That's what the Chidah says. That the only person he allowed to write anything down was Reb Chaim Vital. So that's sort of like, again, he allowed the group to expand, but in terms of maintaining accuracy, the Ari felt very strongly the only person is going to be able to maintain real accuracy. And what he said was Reb Chaim Vital. Okay, now, a number of years after the Ari's death, not that long even, definitely by 1578, the Ari moved to, the Reb Chaim Vital moves to Yerushalayim. In the early 1590s, and again, it's not exactly clear when it happened, and I'm very aware, in case you guys, it doesn't look like anyone's aware of this, there's a really, really wild story about this, which I don't want to say over, so I'm not going to. How's that for that? That is really not nice, isn't it? Dangle, dangle, dangle. But it borders on, even if I turn the recorder off, I wouldn't say it. It borders on the topic, not Kfir Chasachon. It's a topic which is slightly overly complex. I didn't have time to think about it and work through it enough. I have a little to say about it. Maybe I'll speak about it next week a little more. And then maybe I'll tell you the story, maybe not. I'd definitely be willing to, whatever. If I have time, stories like this you have to go over very carefully to move on. Right, so we should understand. Okay. He was in the Bezin of Yerushalayim. I was unable to verify if he actually did that in Damascus also. One sort of assumes, I'm not actually sure the size of the community in Damascus at this time. We saw a little bit earlier that the Jewish community in Constantinople was quite well-to-do and supported a number of rabbis, which in the times of Rishonim was somewhat inspired, but not so much in Ashkenaz. Unclear. But anyway, he spent most of the rest of his life in Damascus. Most of his time he spent, going over the Torah of the Ari. And what he was trying to do was make it, cohesive, comprehensive, Yashiv the Stevis, answer the contradictions, and do as much as he can in it. Now, again, as mentioned earlier, Reb Chaim Vital held you should not publicize what the Ari says. And certainly he was against publishing. He died in 1620.
But his stuff is published.
Right? His stuff was published. He died in 1620. His stuff was not published until the late 1700s. What did you say, Ruben?
1621.
No. His stuff, his ksavim, his writings were not published until the late 1700s, 1782.
What was the printing press again?
The printing press was invented by Gutenberg in the 1460s, 1470s. The first Jewish printings were a little after that. And probably in 2 weeks I'm going to go over printing properly because I have much better sources about it now than I did before. I have the classic. What?
Well, your sources, you can get that from non-Jewish sources.
The best thing about this is a Jewish source because it just is. There's no one alive today who'd put in that amount to work, like the Tiktuk Sefer. Fall Nelson Rabinowitz. We'll speak about it in 2 weeks, but I think that's what I'm going to do. Anyway, so Reb Chaim Vital was quite against publicizing. He did write it. It was written up. The Chidos says he saw the manuscript of what's called Shmona Sha'arim, the Eight Gates. His main sefer was called Derech Eitz Chaim, the path of the tree of life, which is sort of like a pun on his name, and also on the centrality of Kabbalah and the way the Kabbalah look at things. The Chidos says he saw it. Reb Chaim Vital did learn it with worthy individuals, including his son Reb Shmuel Vital. But again, he was against publicizing it. So what happened? So what happens like this. Even though the Ari and Reb Chaim Vital held not to publicize, initially the Reb Chaim Vital not, but afterwards he changed his mind. Right? However, the other Chaverim didn't listen. And the other Chaverim did write things down, even though the Ari told him not to. Not only that, I'm pretty sure this happened in Damascus. Reb Chaim Vital got sick. He was very sick. And someone went and paid his brother. Now, I don't know why his brother would be the one who they would do this with. But they paid his brother a lot of money. And they unlocked his cabinets. took out all his kisvei yad, hired 100 scribes, 100 scribes, copyists, to copy quick. And they sat in 3 days, attempted to copy all of his notebooks. Okay? Now.
Who funded that? The other Chavir?
Say again?
The other Chavir funded that?
No. Who funded it was unclear. I don't have a clear historical source. People knew. No, this isn't Damascus. And it was a known fact that Reb Chaim Vital was the prime source of Torah of the Ari. And again, the Ari's greatness was a well-known fact.
Even then, yes.
Again, I told you, the Ari was not in an oasis. The Ari was
a contemporary, like
the Red Baz, the Red Baz in the Shulchan Aruch and the Yabil Sakara.
Those are all in Sfat.
That's right. With the Ari?
Who are the Gedolim in, like, France and Germany?
There's no Jews in France and Germany.
What are you talking about?
France in the 1500s, no Jews. None. Everyone in Germany was
they
from
all
the for Jews thrown out of France in the Jews really for practical purposes were out of France in the mid 1200s.
Oh yeah, but there was a ban in like
there was a ban back and forth, but they didn't allow public Talmud studying of Shas from I believe the date was 1250, 1240, 1240. And once you can't publicly learn Shas, forget it. You can't have a yeshiva. You can sneak Gemaras here or there, but you can't have a yeshiva unless you can have Gemaras, you know?
Was it Cromwell who lifted up? He lifted
Cromwell's
up.
Much later. Cromwell's
yeah,
16.
No, yeah, but that's Cromwell England. Lifted up the ban in England, but that one was instituted in like 1290, right?
England was also around 1290, but the English Jewish community was never nearly as substantial as the French-German one.
I thought that a type of salutary left in France, meaning there's official expulsion.
No. There were no Jews. It depends. Look, Alsace-Lorraine, I mean, in other words, eastern France wasn't France then. And when France started absorbing it in the mid-1500s, there were small Jewish communities there. But they weren't really that substantial. We don't talk about... There were some Gedolim in Germany at this time, but the heart of Torah... And a Jewry at this point has moved to Poland. That's
when was Rabbi Gershom? I'm sorry.
Rabbi Gershom died 1050.
That was before then.
Well before that.
So basically, Europe doesn't produce any Gedolim from like 1290 to like 1600.
What's Europe? Western Europe?
Yes.
Western Europe. We'll get back to Western Europe. I will get back. Let me just. The Chida points out that when you have 100 copyists working full speed in 3 days, you are going to have mistakes. There's nothing to do about it. You're going to have mistakes, and as a result of this, there were we still see again the Kisvei Reb Chaim Vital were only passed around in manuscript form for almost 200 years. It's unbelievable. I mean, I don't know if this story happened around 1600 or just before his death or a little before his death, but they weren't really printed until the late 1700s. 1783 is the late 1700s. It's at least minimally 165 years. Minimally. That's the bare minimum. It's probably closer to two. The Kisvei Reb Chaim Vital, which are considered the authentic, authoritative source of what the Ari really held, were only in manuscript forms until the late 1600s, until the late 1700s. And the Chida actually says, see, the Reb Shmuel Vital, the Ari's son, ended up moving to Cairo. And the Chida actually reports that he saw the official Ksav Yad, the official manuscript of Kisvei Ari, Kisvei Reb Chaim Vital.
Why didn't they had 100 different scripts running around?
No, it wasn't 100 different. In other words, he had, let's say, 50 notebooks.
Oh.
They had each scribe copy a notebook. Full speed, though. I mean, their hands must have hurt after doing that for a day straight, for 3 days straight. You know, professional Sofrim say, for the records, professional Sofrim will tell you that you can only work, at least Ashkenazi Sofrim, they can only work 6 hours a day maximum. Maximum. Because it's very difficult, tedious work.
Get arthritis.
I mean, that may eventually happen. I'm just talking before they get the arthritis. to hold the whatever it takes. There's only so much you can write. I'm not sure. You know, Sephardi Sofrim use a reed. Ashkenazi Sofrim use a quill, and Sephardi Sofrim use a reed. A reed. You know what a reed is? A reed is a piece of wood.
Yeah.
It's much easier to write with.
Reeds in the sea.
Yeah.
Plant.
Plant.
They said a piece of wood.
Yeah. Yeah. It dries up and it looks like a piece of wood.
A piece of wood.
Okay.
Isn't grass like?
Yeah.
They're soft when they're wet, and when they dry.
When they dry, they get pretty hard. I've seen a kan. I've seen kan. It's called kan sofrim. I've seen it. Okay. Anyway, Bekitzer, that was a rough piece of work, but it was done. Okay. Okay. Maral. Let's go on to the Maral.
I've seen.
I didn't hear that one. Let's go on to the Maharal.
No, it's smaller.
The Maharal. Now, it is not clear exactly when the Maharal was born. Some people say the Maharal was born as early as 1512. I don't know what it says on the kever either. I mean, I was there also 2.5 years ago. It's most likely he was born closer to 1526. And it's not clear where he was born, but he was probably born in Poland and possibly in Poznan. Died in 1609. The Maharal, do you know what the Maharal's name was?
Oh, yes, I do. Oh, my God, I just saw it. I was just reading it. I was like, wow, that's not his name.
Is
it with a B? Something, there's a B in
no,
the
no.
first letter.
No. Okay, Rabbi Yehuda Rival.
I was confused
being on. Ben Bezalel.
Confused
what?
Ben
Bezalel. Yeah.
Okay. Maybe not Ben Bezalel, because he's your brother Bezalel. Anyway, Rabbi Yehuda, the Maharal, why is he called Maharal then? His name is Yehuda.
Moreno
Harav, Rabbi Mari. Riva. 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 What do you think Riva means? I'm not even sure if that's a proper pronunciation for the records. As you'll see why in a moment. No.
What is it?
It is written in Hebrew.
1,000.
Yeah. No. Lithuania is?
Litha.
Mahara.
Levi. Levi.
Reino Harav Riva. Okay, should I give you a hint?
Not Levi?
Nope, nothing to do with Levi. His real name was Yehuda.
Levi.
Excellent. Gildan, on the dot. Yehuda today is Yehuda Levi. Why is Yehuda Yehuda Levi?
Wait, T-Bag.
It's just the same name, just in another language.
No. Yehuda today, the nickname for Yehuda today, Yehuda Levi. The reason why is Yehuda.
Levi.
Gur Aryeh.
Oh, what?
Where does it say Yehuda Gur Aryeh?
Gur Aryeh.
Gur Aryeh Yehuda Mitara Fani Aliza.
Oh, that's a Chumash.
That is Yaakov's Bracha. And Yaakov's Bracha Yehuda is called Yehuda Gur Aryeh. Gur Aryeh Yehuda.
How's that transferred to Leib?
Leib in Yiddish, German is Lion. So what do you think it's more possible that this name should be said as? Lion in Latin?
Leo.
Leo.
Leo. That's like James
Leo.
Leo.
It's Pod. Maybe it's a kinui for Leo. Nonetheless, that's the Maharal. Okay.
Leo.
Yeah. The Maharal spent most of his life in what's called It was called in those days Morovia. Somewhat, it's a little bit Bohemia, but a lot of time in Morovia.
Sorry.
Yeah. Okay, Morovia today is the eastern halves of the Czech Republic. And the western half was traditionally called Bohemia, and the eastern half was called Morovia.
Yeah, Prague is in Czech. Well, now it's
Prague is in Bohemia.
But it used to be part of Russia.
No, Russia. It was never part of Russia.
It was part of
Austria.
Austria. And then
Austria Austrians ruled Bohemia practically from 1500, they ruled Bohemia from 1526 and on, and maybe a little earlier than that. Bohemia, Bohemia Moravia, was a semi, was a sort of independent country. They were, whatever, they went back and forth here, there, and the next. Sometimes they were together with Hungary, sometimes with Poland. But after 1526, with the demise of Hungary because of the Ottomans, they were almost permanently, it's a little before that. It's a little before that. That's not 1526. Because of the, you know, Hungary was basically absorbed into Austria. Because of, you know, 1526, I think, is when they were
defeated. So it was like part of Austria.
It was always part of so Austria.
Was that the time that was the Marl during Joseph II of Austria's?
No, Joseph is much later.
Joseph II.
Joseph II died in 1790.
But he was like really good to the Jews, right? He was like the best.
Joseph II is a complicated figure. I could tell you, I could discuss it at dinner. Okay.
He's my boy. I love him.
Okay, now Joseph II was called Enlightened Despot. Okay. He mainly was in Nikolsburg and Prague, back and forth between the two a number of times. He opened a yeshiva in Prague. He opened a yeshiva in Prague in 1570 something or so. One of the reasons why he opened his yeshiva was because he disliked Rabbi Yaakov Pollock's system of pilpul. He was a big opponent of pilpul. We discussed the problems. It's a well-known historical problem to quantify pilpul. Of course, you know, as I said a number of times, most historians don't know how to learn a Tosos, so therefore they have difficulties quantifying other things also, and they're relying on second, third, fourth hand sources for a lot of these things. But the specific problem of pilpul is no one ever wrote a sefer of pilpul. So we don't have much to do. We know what the opponent said about it, but we don't know what the proponent said about it.
What is it?
It's unclear. It's like try to argue a point without real substance. That's what the opponents said about pilpul. His most famous Talmud was the Tosos Yontif. His most famous Talmud was the Tosos Yontif. That's right. And one of the things that the Maharal was very well known for was he strongly held that everyone should learn Mishnah. You shouldn't start learning Gemara until you're around 15.
You know,
there's no way I'm not going to be able to give another pitch for Mishnah now, right? Okay, he even incorporated, he felt Mishnah was so important. What?
What's so good about Mishnah?
Gilded? You're asking for it, man. You press the button.
It gives you a grasp on all of Shas, and you know where things are. And
it's a good thing I'm going through Shas.
There you go. The Maral felt it was so important that he even made his Yeshiva Bachram learn Mishnah.
Rabbi,
Yeshiva Bachram, has his well-known fact, have a certain opposition to learning Mishnah. They think that's for little kids in Cheder. So it's not a new problem. The problem's at least 450 years old. And the Maharal was very against it. And he forced his Yeshiva Bachram also to learn Mishnah. And again, how can I not tell you? I don't know what life was like 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago. I don't know. I can tell you that I know what's going on today. Most people are not going to be Bekiyim and Shas. I can tell you that. Most people aren't. But everyone can master Mishnah. It's not beyond you. And the more you know Mishnah, the more you'll be able to deal with Gemara. You won't be so confused. When the Gemara starts quoting Mishnahs all over the place, you're not like, it'll take you 20 minutes to figure out each Mishnah, what's going on. If you have Mishnah, if you understand Mishnah solidly, then the Shas will flow.
He's
not considered one of the major opponents of Shulchan Aruch. There are people who are, but he's not one of them. Okay, now the Maharal unfortunately only left over a small amount of Chidushim on Shas and classic sugyas. We'll get to the Guru Aryeh in a moment. But his style is very, very classic style. It's like It's sort of like a pre-modern style. In other words, it'll be more similar to, you know, Ramdish, you know, latish achronim like Tixos, etc., than it will be to most people his time. But he only left a small amount of it, so it's hard to know what would have been if he would have spent more time on that or put more of that down in writing. Now, he's best known for Machshava, quotes Jewish thought. It's not. I'm not going to be able to finish this whole thing right now. So the first sefer he printed, and historically speaking, the one that was really known, was Gur Aryeh. He printed the Gur Aryeh in his life in 1573.
Peirushon Rashi.
Peirushon Rashi, that's right. He printed the Gur Aryeh in 1573.
It's not all of Peirushon Rashi, right? It's like a lot of Hishkan.
Okay, just wait a second. I'm going to explain it to you. I'll explain it to you in a moment. Literally a moment. Now, there's no question at all. The Gur Aryeh is one of the most important Peirushim on Rashi. You know, again, the first, even it's not Mamish the first, but historically, Ke'ila, but sort of like Columbus discovering America, he wasn't really the first person to be there, but historically he discovered America. So, I mean, it's not totally true that Mizrahi wasn't really the first, but in terms of Mefarshei Rashi, he's like the first. So the Maharal is, the Maharal to the Mizrahi is like the Ramban to Rashi. Yeah, you got that? Okay, no, you didn't. Okay. The Maharal, the Mizrahi wrote a Peirush.
Oh, that would remember like the Mizrahi.
Rabbi Eliezer, I spoke about him a couple of weeks ago before Pesach. He's the first of the Mefarshei Rashi, at least in a linear historical terms. He's the first of the Mefarshei Rashi. He's somewhat heavy, which means he goes through the, you know, the Psukim and the Midrashim, what?
Yeah.
And the Midrashim. He's the one who started, you know, like a lot of the very basic ideas, Ke'ila, the classic answers to Rashi, a lot of them are Mizrahis. And the Maharal spends a lot of time arguing with the Mizrahi. He doesn't always argue with him, but he spends a lot of time arguing with him. He's not quite as heavy. In other words, in most Rashis, what are you trying to do? If you're a Mefarish of Rashi, what are you trying to do? You want to know, why did Rashi bring this Midrash on this Pasuk? Where does he see the connection? Where did Chazal get it from? Why is this the best of the Midrashim to bring? So the Mizrahi is somewhat heavier. It's lengthier and heavier. In other words, he'll go a little bit more into the Midrashim than the Maharal will. The Maharal won't go quite as much in. And that's one of the things he does. And the other thing that the Maharal does and the Mizrahi practically doesn't do at all is the funny, what I call funny Rashis. Do you know what I mean? We know what I mean by funny Rashi? Okay, let's...
Wants to make you laugh.
No, they shouldn't make you laugh, but no, there's no, is there a chumash here with Rashi? Okay, whip over a chumash. Okay, I'll give you one of these Rashis. I'll give you a Rashi. Shmos Perek Dalet Pasuk Chaf. Moshe Rabbeinu has the first meeting with Hashem at Sinai. He goes to collect his wife and children. Pasuk says, "Vayikach Moshe es ishto v'zbanav v'yarkivei mal hachamor v'yashuv aretz Mitzrayim." Moshe took his wife and his children, and he put them on the donkey. Yeah, you know, remember the Rashi Menachem?
Yeah.
Rashi says, "Chamer miyuchad uchamer shechavash Avram lekedes Yitzchak." This is the donkey that Avram rode to the Akedah, and this is the donkey that the Melch Mashiach is going to ride.
I don't think the donkey's lifespan
is less. Gildan says, does this mean that donkey lived? This is a donkey that's going to be almost, you know, 3,500 years old, around 4,000, close to 4,000 years old.
He's going to show up.
Comes up. How do you understand such a chazal?
I'm an old donkey.
How do we understand such a chazal? So I don't remember if I quoted the Rambam, but I may have. The Rambam says this is a classic chazal that the Rambam in the Hakdama to Perasha Mishnah says. Maybe it's in Chiluk, but it's in one of those places. It's a Meir chazal that doesn't make any sense, and you can't figure out pshat and you can't understand it. Then you should assume there's something deep going on. It's just beyond your comprehension. You shouldn't be malig. You shouldn't make fun of Chazal.
When we say it's beyond our comprehension, do we mean that it's literally, like it's literal to be taken literal, and it's beyond our comprehension?
Okay, we will talk about that a little more next week. I want to do a little more practical, refreshing of my memory and looking things up a little, because I do want to speak a little more about the Maharal next week, and I'm going to speak about that next week. And I did not have time. The Maharal over here is too long. I only looked at it for like 8-9 minutes, and that was not long enough. But the basic of the Maharal over here is that donkey, chamor, a donkey is the epitome of physicality in this world, because chomer, the world, materialism in the world is chomer, and chamor is the epitome of the chomer. So when we're talking about these three places, it's not just a coincidence, it's three times where people are overcoming the primordial physicality in that is an intrinsic part of this world. That's how the Maharal more or less explains pshat. We want to know, does that mean that it's physically the same donkey or not? That, Bezer Hashem, I'll speak about a little more next week. Fine.
Oh, yeah.
It's an important topic, and it just needs a little more treatment. I didn't have quite enough time.